In this hour of the program, we will be taking up a subject we have talked about before, and certainly earlier this week we talked about it, and that is ethanol. There are certainly a lot of people who are turning to ethanol, or at least are interested in ethanol, and that interest is fueled by questions about the availability, continued availability of oil, and also the price. And for those reasons and others, there are a lot of people who have embraced ethanol as an alternative to oil. They make that argument that ethanol will reduce our reliance on oil imports, that it's good for the economy, that it will help farmers. Other people are skeptical. They question the environmental impact of ethanol production, as well as the potential energy gain. Earlier on the program, we had a journalist who has written a lot about energy issues. Robert Bryce was his name, someone who identified himself as an ethanol skeptic, not necessarily an ethanol opponent, but one who has some questions about ethanol and what it may be able to do for us. Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we have someone who very clearly is a supporter of the idea of ethanol. Our guest is Brian Jennings. He's Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. This is a group that was formed in 1988. It is the largest group of its kind here in the United States, has more than 1,400 members in 47 states, including ethanol producers and farmers. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Jennings, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Anything else in particular you would like to say about the American Coalition for Ethanol?
You covered much of it. I think I would add that we work in a number of ways to advance the ethanol industry. We work on public policy issues at the state and federal level in Congress. We also work to educate the public about the benefits of ethanol. And then finally, we work with oil companies and with petroleum marketers and retailers to help them overcome barriers to using ethanol. We find that working with them is much more effective than trying to work against them. And so we try to embrace our customers, who are also our competitors, and help them try to use more ethanol. So that's all I would share.
Okay. How much ethanol is produced in the United States now?
Today we produce just over 5 billion gallons of ethanol, and that is a huge increase from where we've been in the past. However, it's still a small fraction of our overall gasoline use. We use about 140 billion gallons of gasoline, and so ethanol is growing, but it comprises still just about 4% of our transportation fuel.
Okay. And the one of the things that I think I'm sure got a lot of people's attention was recent remarks by the president in the State of the Union address, where he was talking about energy issues and talking about wanting to see a significant increase. Now, how much do you think, you know, let's say over the next few years, what would be the most optimistic number that you could put on how much more? So today we're producing 5 billion gallons of ethanol. Let's say 5 years from now, how much do you think we could be producing?
Well, I think the president's State of the Union speech was welcomed, but it was incredibly ambitious and aggressive as well. The forecasting and numbers crunching that we've done in my office indicate that we believe in the next 5 years or so we'll be producing somewhere between 12 and 15 billion gallons of ethanol,
Okay. Which
is very substantial. But to get to the president's goal is going to require a lot of political willpower and technology innovations.
Well, this, I suppose this gets at one of the basic questions that people have, particularly when you look at the argument that says, well, it's a good thing for us to be developing this industry because it will decrease our dependence on oil, significant amounts of which has to be imported. And even if we could get to the point where we might be producing 12 to 15 billion gallons of ethanol, when you take a look at our consumption of gasoline, which is right today at, I think you said, 140 billion, I think a lot of people would say, boy, that's the proverbial drop in the bucket. Is it really even worth it to try to develop this industry? And maybe people in agriculture would say, well, sure it is, because it's another opportunity for us to make something out of the crop. But in terms, if what you're really concerned about is the issue of dependence on oil, it really doesn't look like ethanol is going to do very much for that.
You know, that's a very common question. I appreciate you asking it. We've always contended that there really is no silver bullet to our energy security needs, meaning that ethanol was never intended to replace all of the gasoline that we use in the United States. And if people believe that, then that's unfortunate. And we've never tried to mislead people along those lines. We are confident, however, that when cellulosic technology comes on to be commercially successful, that biofuels such as ethanol and biodiesel will be able to replace upwards of half to a little more than half of all of the gasoline that we use. And then it's going to be up to other technologies and other alternatives, biobutanol, perhaps hydrogen someday. We all need to focus more on conservation and energy efficiency. And if you put all of those factors together, biofuels will probably make up the biggest dent in reducing the foreign oil dependence. But those other alternatives will have to pick up as well if we're going to make a meaningful difference on our foreign oil addiction.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to talk for a little bit, or we could talk for a little bit about cellulosic ethanol. I think that there are a lot of people who believe that there's great potential here. There certainly is research going on this campus and other places looking at that possibility of other plant sources to generate that ethanol. And I think that, though, again, the people who raise some questions, they say, well, for example, they say if you look at a place like Brazil, they're making their ethanol out of sugarcane, and that's a great source of the alcohol, a great feedstock, because you're already starting with something that's got a lot of sugar in it. Corn, not as good, but, you know, it's not bad. If you look at something like a grass, like miscanthus or switchgrass, you got to have an awful lot of grass to make an equivalent amount of ethanol, as if you compare that to a feedstock like corn or cane. And that, you know, not only does it, you have to figure out how you're going to grow that much switchgrass, how you're going to get it to the plant, how you're going to do the processing. And of course, there's actually no, I'm not sure that we really even have a process yet to do it. So you've got to figure out how you're going to do it. You've got to develop an industry from the ground up. You got significant issues with growing and producing and moving your feedstock. I think that some people would say, man, that's a cellulosic ethanol is a long, long way away, if ever.
Sure, that's a sophisticated question, and I'll try to address it the best I can. There are real and incredible opportunities that we believe will come from cellulosic ethanol, but the challenges are very, very real as well, and you've outlined a number of them. Thankfully, we do have a tremendous amount of biomass in the United States already and an incredible ability to grow more biomass. And so regarding the question about won't it take a lot of this stuff to actually make more ethanol, you're absolutely right about that, but we have a tremendous opportunity to grow things like switchgrass, big bluestem, other perennial native prairie grasses, and other biomass products. But the challenges are significant, and I sort of lump them into four primary areas. The first challenge is to overcome some of the technology costs. The technology is there today to make ethanol from cellulose. We're doing it in laboratories all across the United States, indeed all across the world. But the cost of converting that cellulose into the sugars to make the ethanol is dramatically more than it is to make it out of corn in the United States, or, as you indicated, sugar in places like Brazil. And so a lot of research and development is taking part on the public and private side to drive down those costs. And I think good progress is being made there. The second hurdle then we have to overcome is the capital cost of building these facilities. These facilities may be similar to the corn ethanol plants that we have today, but they may be dramatically different as well. And there's a risk inherent in building these plants because the technology is unproven on a commercial scale. And so that's where the federal government has stepped in and said, we will provide loan guarantees to help get some of these first biorefinery started. And so we're working in Congress to fund that loan guarantee program. There are several companies around the country that have applied for that assistance. And very soon this year, we believe the Department of Energy will announce some awards to help drive down the cost of building those facilities so they can get up and running by perhaps 2009. The third issue that we need to address is maybe the most daunting, and that has to do with the handling, the transportation, the storage, the growing of this biomass, as you've indicated in your question. We need to make sure that we have the equipment that can handle it. We need to drive down the cost. Maybe it's one-pass technology that harvests a corn product but also captures that stover, and then making sure it's dry and in dense enough quantities that we can handle it at the facility in an efficient way and in a scaled-up fashion. And most of these hurdles have been overlooked, and I think that's what's going to trip us up here if we don't pay more attention to those factors. And then the final issue that really is overlooked as well that we need to address is one of sustainability. Yes, biomass is one of the most abundant resources on the face of the earth, and we know we can grow more here in the United States as well. But we want to make sure that we're protecting our soil and maintaining water quality, preventing erosion. We can't take all the corn stover off a field. We can't take all the wheat or rice straw off fields. We need to make sure we're protecting wildlife habitat. And so doing all of these things in a sustainable way is going to require some balance. And so it's a complicated process and a complicated question. I believe we have the technology and the willpower to get it done eventually in the United States, but it is a ways off.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Brian Jennings, he is Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. It is a national nonprofit organization, more than 1,400 members, among them ethanol producers and farmers. It was formed in 1988, and this is the second of two programs we've done this week, looking at some of the pros and cons of ethanol as people see them. And certainly it's something I'm sure we will continue to be talking about here on Focus. I'm sure it will continue to be addressed by our Ag News Service. And it's something that we know that people around here are very interested in for a variety of reasons. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have a number of people lined up here and ready to go. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also do have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We'll start with Belgium, the community not too far away over by Danville. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I would like to point out that in this area, Midwest, this portion of Midwest, there's push to put an ethanol refining plant on about every corner of every street, it seems like. Every day we hear about another one wanting to go up in one area or another. And I am not a farmer, but from the farmers I do speak of, they keep saying, you know, there's not enough corn to go around. You know, we still want to drink beer and have corn flakes and everything else. There's not enough corn to do both. You can't drive all the cars and feed all the people. It just is not going to fly. And we're in the same vein, Europe, well, at least northern Scandinavian Europe and places like that, are rapidly moving towards hydrogen. And we do have nuclear power to generate hydrogen. I know people don't like nuclear power, but it does not release carbon into the atmosphere. And there's many ways to refine hydrogen from water and from coal and many other things, biomass also. It seems we should step past the methanol straight to the hydrogen economy, which is really much more sustainable and much better in the long run.
Well, Mr. Jennings, you want to speak to some of that?
Sure. I'll take the latter part of the comment or question first, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. My association doesn't do any work on hydrogen. I'm not an expert on hydrogen, so I don't have the skill set to address the question, other than to say this, that we believe we need a wide variety of alternatives, and we're certainly not opposed to hydrogen, and we would like to see the United States move to a more clean climate technology for transportation fuels. And so hydrogen should be part of the mix. I don't know how far off that is, however. We'll let other experts work on that. But we welcome the advent of hydrogen in a cost-effective way here. The first question or comment had to deal with the push to build a lot of ethanol plants in your state and elsewhere, and whether it's corn, and that's a very good question. The rush to build all of these plants has really been precipitated by the profitability and the strong market conditions that existed in 2006. We had a lot of factors coming together to make 2006 an unparalleled year for the ethanol industry. Today, however, the marketplace is dramatically different. As the caller noted, we don't have a limitless supply of corn to go around, and we see corn prices increasing rapidly today, which is a good thing, especially for farmers, but we see ethanol prices going down, and so it's making ethanol production less profitable. We want people to be very careful about where they site these ethanol plants. They need to make sure there's adequate corn available and make sure they're not make sure they are looking at the competitive uses for corn in their area, whether that be for livestock or other processing. But the truth of the matter is we often underestimate the ability of American farmers to produce corn. And we're not getting into that situation, I'm very confident, where we're creating this question of are we going to use corn for food or for fuel. I'm confident we can use corn for both, but we have to do this in a smart way. We can't build a plant on every corner, as the caller said. We know that that would be irresponsible. But I do think that corn farmers are going to be more productive. The marketplace will be cyclical. I think the market will send signals today for farmers in Illinois and around the country to plant more corn. More corn will likely lead to lower cost or lower price at some point in time, and we'll go through the cycle all over again. But I'm confident that we can and should build more ethanol plants, but we have to be careful about where we do it.
May I ask a little bit more of a question, too, or point out another aspect of it? With ethanol, you are tied to the price per barrel of crude oil. And the price per barrel of crude oil is dictated by many factors, both geopolitical and the aspect of whether it is there or not. And large energy corporations already control all of the oil production. And they can, if they want to force you out of business, they just start pushing more oil and bring the price of oil down low enough that it's no longer economically viable to produce methanol or ethanol, pardon me. And it seems that you're still stuck to the same problem there, where if you step past into the hydrogen, you can generate it at the point of need in your house if you have to. Use excess electricity that's at nighttime to produce the hydrogen you can use during the day. Many more aspects of it are far more intelligent usage of our energy and our resources. Thank you very much.
Just to stay just for a second with this issue of price and supply, and there has, as you point out, there has been recently and relatively recently an increase in the price of corn, and I'm sure that there are a number of reasons for that. I'm sure some people will tell you why, and I'm, you know, I know people say they can tell you why the markets go up and down. I'm not sure that they really know, but anyway, they can tell you why, and I'm sure that ethanol has something to do with that. There, I think some people are concerned that if ethanol becomes, if the demand continues to go up and the expectation that's going to be there continues to go up and processors think that they can make money, that might well indeed keep prices up for corn, and that's good for farmers, but people worry about what that means for the price of food. Do you think that at the end of the line that if ethanol, this industry continues to develop, that's good for the price of corn, that people are going to end up paying for it one way or another because corn is in, and corn derivatives are in so many products, not just food products, but all kinds of products that we use every day?
Well, it is true that corn has many important customers. The livestock sector being the most important, I suppose, customer you would say today, because they use most of the U.S. corn crop. Followed by many industrial uses, including the processing of corn for ethanol. And as you've indicated, some of it goes into the human food supply as well. It's often overstated, however, how much corn goes directly to the human food supply. It's about 7 to 8% of our corn crop, meaning more than 90% of the remainder of the corn goes to other uses. And so I want to make that point so your readers don't think half the corn crop's going into cornflakes or some other human food, because it's not. As the demand for corn increases, the data that we've looked at indicates that history, anyway, would illustrate that as demand for corn increases, there are corresponding increases in supply. Farmers don't, the supply is not static. Farmers are going to implement some of the production efficiencies that enable them to grow more corn on the same amount of acres. The market signals today are probably going to signal the farmers to shift away from some crops and plant more corn, so that will help increase the supply as well. The ethanol industry helps play a role in replacing some of the corn that's lost from livestock production when we make ethanol, because the co-product of ethanol production is something called distiller's grain, which is a very high protein feed component that livestock producers and feeders can use in their rations to supplement corn. And so we're providing some of that back to the livestock sector. And the technology innovations are very exciting today when it comes to drought tolerance or some of the other work that the seed companies are doing that will enable us, I'm confident, to be more productive in the future. So the national average for corn yield today might be, 150, 160 bushels per acre. It seems that USDA and others are confident that we'll be pushing 200-plus bushels an acre for a national average yield in the future. And so we do need to be careful, and I want to make it very clear, there are limits on how much corn we can and should use for ethanol. But the marketplace, I think, is best equipped to do that. And I'm no expert in consumer prices, but some of the data that I've read indicates that all of the factors, including ethanol, that are contributing to a corn price increase today aren't necessarily leading to significantly higher prices at the retail level for consumers who buy corn products. It just doesn't seem to work that way. And so I don't want to dismiss those concerns, but I think those concerns are often overstated.
We're about our midpoint here. We have several other callers, and we'll get right back to the calls. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Brian Jennings. He is Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. It is a national nonprofit organization, more than 1,400 members in 47 states, including ethanol producers and farmers. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Urbana, next, line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for the program. Very interesting. I want to start it by saying I'm a pretty rabid ethanol opponent, actually. Biomass is soil mining. And here in East Central Illinois, the gift of the native prairie will only last us so long. And so I appreciate your comments that showed some sensitivity to that issue. If, for example, we had a rational policy for corporate average fuel economy in the United States that was progressive and might help us out of the energy crisis that we're in, I might be a little bit more of an ethanol proponent. But if the F-150 continues to be the most popular vehicle sold in America, I don't want us to mine our soils to make, to make up the difference. What are your best estimates right now for conversion efficiency with the wet or dry milling processes that are currently used?
Sure. Today, on average, one bushel of corn that's processed through a dry grind ethanol facility will yield 2.7 to 2.8 gallons of ethanol. Some ethanol producers are telling us that they can already get 2.9 to 3 gallons of ethanol from a bushel, but some aren't not that efficient. But they are trying to use more and new technologies that will increasingly enable them to more efficiently convert that corn product. And if I may, I just want to respond to the first part of the comment. I am sensitive, and our organization and my members are sensitive to the sustainability issues, and we don't advocate soil mining, as the caller used the phrase. And I would wholeheartedly agree with the caller that we need a more rational policy when it comes to CAFE standards. It's a little bit silly that the automakers are getting these credits for making, you know, Tahoes and F-150s flexible fuel compatible, and we applaud them for that. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad they're making more flexible fuel vehicles. But those automakers get those credits whether a drop of E85 is used in those cars or not. And I would be supportive of looking at ways to ensure that the fuel that's designed to go in those alternative fuel-type vehicles actually does get used. So I'm not against a more rational policy on CAFE standards. As I tried to say from the start, we've never said ethanol is the silver bullet. There's no such thing as a silver bullet, and so we need a wide variety of alternatives, and one of them is more efficient vehicles and more efficient use of fuel, and so we're behind you on that.
Yeah, okay, great. I guess the number for the conversion that I was looking for is kind of the standard sort of ratio to one value that I've heard applied in the range of 1.13 or so for ethanol production in terms of maybe it's just a gas in, ethanol out equation, and like in the range of 2.5 for biodiesel. Are you familiar with the use of those?
I guess I'm not. I'm a little confused by the question. I apologize for that.
That's all right. Yeah, I appreciate your spirit, and I guess what I've been thinking about for a while, you know, to make true believers out of this, you know, what I would offer is what I've thought about as the demo farm challenge. You know, I'll give you a 10,000-gallon gas or diesel start, and show me that you can run a farm of, you know, 2,000 acres on good ground and make enough ethanol by whatever means of production you choose to actually close the loop on the system. You know, sort of, if you would, a biosphere approach, if you remember the Biosphere 2 now I think we have out in the desert of Arizona, so that you could actually grow, convert, and resupply, and sort of make that a self-sustaining system. Big project, but I think it would be pretty good PR for people who were talking about ethanol production. I'll get off the phone and let someone else have a chance. Thank you again, David.
I wonder if Brian, I think maybe what the caller is getting at, and certainly I'll raise it now, somebody else might be preparing to raise it, is the question about how much energy it takes to produce ethanol and whether, in fact, you have an energy gain or you got a net loss, because there are some people who have argued, and I know people argue over these studies, there are some people who have argued that, in fact, if you take a look at all of the inputs that goes into producing ethanol, that and a lot of that it ends up being fossil fuel, that it turns out that some people would say it actually takes more energy to produce it than you get back. What is your take on that?
Sure, and as he was describing in the last comment, I that light bulb came on too, that he was referring to energy balance. This has been a long debated issue when it comes to ethanol, but when it comes to all of the studies that have been conducted on this, the vast majority of them indicate very clearly that ethanol does have a positive net energy balance, and the latest one from the United States Department of Agriculture indicates that there's about a 77% net energy gain, meaning for every BTU of energy that goes into making a gallon of ethanol, that gallon of ethanol contains 77 more BTUs than was used to make that. Another way of looking at it is that today it takes about 35,000 British thermal units of energy in an ethanol plant to make a gallon of ethanol. And a gallon of ethanol, while it doesn't contain as many BTUs as a gallon of gasoline, contains almost 80,000 BTUs of energy. And so only 35,000 BTUs of energy to make it, and it contains somewhere between 77 and 80,000 BTUs. So it is a positive energy balance, and you know, those questions have come up throughout the years, but the history of the studies and research done on this indicates that it's very crystal clear. It's a positive energy balance.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Urbana Line 2.
Hello. Oh,
yes.
I have a question regarding the price of ethanol. When we were paying under a dollar for gasoline, the ethanol industry was subsidized by our tax money. When we went up to well over $3, the ethanol was still subsidized. What is your estimate when ethanol industry can do without a subsidy? And the second part is, if I am supposed to subsidize ethanol industry, what is the argument for that compared to me subsidizing higher efficiency cars?
Sure.
That's my question.
Okay. Well, thank you for the question. It's important for all of the listeners to recognize that energy in itself is subsidized, if that's the word that we want to use. Oil and gasoline are heavily subsidized. In fact, what ethanol gets pales in comparison to what oil and gasoline industries receive from the federal government in terms of tax credits and subsidies. Solar, wind, those types of energies are subsidized. Electricity receives help from the federal government. And so energy in itself is what some may refer to as a distorted marketplace, meaning not necessarily free market fundamentals do not necessarily drive the energy marketplace. And so I want to make that point first so people don't think ethanol is the only energy sector out there that receives any public support, because it's not. They all do. Beyond that, ethanol gallons receive a tax credit today because ethanol can be more expensive to make than gasoline. Oftentimes people think it's cheaper, but not necessarily. Ethanol can be more expensive to make, but because it's a public policy priority to displace gasoline and oil with cleaner burning and domestic alternatives, Congress has said, let's give a tax credit to oil companies as an incentive for them to buy this stuff and blend it with gasoline. And we need that tax credit because, left to their own devices, of course, oil companies would rather not use something they don't make. They don't own ethanol plants. They own refineries. They make gasoline from oil. So every gallon of ethanol that they would have to buy displaces something that they make at their own facilities. And so that tax credit is an important incentive to help them buy our product, and it is typically passed on to consumers in terms of a lower price at the pump. And that's one of the beauties of the way the tax credit works. And so how long will that tax credit need to be in place? Sure, you're not surprised to hear this. My organization is trying to extend it for as long and far as we can because we think it's really a sound public policy. And, you know, if the oil and gasoline industries were willing to give up all of the public support that they receive, you know, we'd entertain that as well. But I don't see anyone asking for support to the oil and gasoline industries to go away.
I am. You'll be surprised to say. But subsidies is a totally, it's a subject in itself. My question was more in the direction of what would have to be the gasoline price before ethanol industry can say, well, yes, at this price we are competitive and theoretically at least we wouldn't need the subsidy. That you would like to continue to have the subsidy, I understand. When everybody else gets that, you want it too. But on the other hand, the subsidy issue is just as common in farming as it is on the oil industry. I'm not supporting either one of them, but because that has worldwide repercussions to all kinds of people in other countries as well. My question was, what would have to be the gasoline price before ethanol can say, well, at that level, we can live without subsidies?
Well, I appreciate the question and your your ambition in getting me to try and answer it, but I don't agree with the premise of your comment or your question. So I don't think there is a price that I can say will address what you're talking about. The federal government provides taxpayer money to a wide variety of things for a wide variety of reasons, and we think there are very compelling reasons why support goes to the ethanol industry. And so, you know, I appreciate your perspective. I just don't agree with it, and there isn't a, I don't know what, you know, you need or want me to say, but I'm not going to say anything about a price of gasoline and support for ethanol.
Well, I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're going on to our last about 10 minutes, and I have a number of other callers. I'd like to try to get some other folks in. Maybe, again, I'll just quickly introduce the guest, Brian Jennings. He's Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. Let's go next to line three. This is Bloomington. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a pleasure to hear this discourse. And as a person in agriculture for the last 30-plus years, I am in favor of your organization. But my question is more generic. Is there the true political desire to find alternative sources of energy?
That's a great question. And I might get in trouble for saying this, but...
Well, I want you to be straight. Forward, and if you think it's too political for you to answer, because I have my doubts about it.
No, that's the reason I said I might get in trouble, because the first thing I want to say is that we are very thankful and grateful for the enormous support that we receive from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle and from state and local elected officials as well. But I, too, question whether there is real, passionate, deep political willpower to search for alternatives to oil. I don't think there is enough of that in Congress. I don't think there is enough of that at the state and local levels. And it almost seems as if we need some sort of a crisis to drive elected officials to do something about it. For instance, the hurricanes that we unfortunately experienced here back in 2005, you saw a lot of activity in Congress. We need to do something about our foreign oil dependence. We need to do something about our oil dependence. We need to do something about the concentration of refineries and oil drilling in the Gulf. So there was a lot of flurry of activity, and then that tends to go away when the price of gasoline at the pump goes back down to quote-unquote reasonable levels, whatever those are. And I wish we wouldn't manage this energy security situation from one crisis to the next. I wish that there was more consistent willpower. And that's one thing that my organization is supposed to try and do, build some momentum at the grassroots level and create some activity in Congress. We're working hard to do that, but I wish there were enough. I wish there were more. And all I can say is we're very thankful for the leaders that we have today, and we're trying to work with them to build more support.
I just have one comment, and that is that $3.50 a gallon fuel oil is gasoline is a crisis for me as a consumer. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's go on to somebody else here. We have a caller in, Matt Toon. Let's talk with them. Line four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question and comment. One is... why does the farm lobby, and I'm not sure about your organization, but why do they oppose importing ethanol from Brazil? And I know there's a tariff, and the reason there is a tariff is because the farm lobby is trying to hold it on, and it sounds like it's the money. And I'm wondering, the imports of ethanol from Brazil surely wouldn't be all that great, but it might help some. Any comment?
Sure. We imported a little over 500 million gallons of ethanol, maybe close to 600 million gallons of ethanol, in 2006, and upwards of three-fourths of that came from Brazil. And so we do import ethanol when we need it, and most of the time comes from Brazil. But there is a tariff on ethanol imports that come from Brazil. You are correct. And my organization strongly supports that tariff. And I think the reason for it is this. We talked earlier about the ethanol subsidy, and that's a tax credit that goes to every gallon of ethanol that oil companies blend with gasoline. Well, that tax credit goes to the ethanol, whether it's made from an ethanol plant in Illinois or whether it comes from Brazil. And so the tax credit benefit doesn't discriminate on country of origin. All ethanol receives it no matter where it comes from. To offset, then, that tax credit, so U.S. taxpayer dollars aren't being essentially wired to Brazil to help them make more ethanol, we offset it with a corresponding tariff. So it's in place, really, to protect U.S. taxpayers from sending our funds to Brazil. If something were to change and we were to say, well, any imports of ethanol from Brazil won't get this other tax credit for blending, well, then we wouldn't necessarily need the tariff. But as long as that is the program we have in place, we're going to strongly support continuing the tariff, which is in place until January 1 of 2009 right now. And I think the last thing I would say is Brazil doesn't have a whole lot of excess ethanol to send us. They use a significant amount there. And so the 500-some million gallons they probably sent last year is probably about the upwards reach of what they're able to ship to the United States anyway.
Well, they must be able to do it very cheaply to be able to pay that tariff and send it in. And it just appears like what it is, it's the money. You want to keep that price of corn real high.
Well, the market conditions were strong last year, and that did allow for Brazilian ethanol to come in and still pay the tariff. And I guess if the ethanol industry has helped increase agriculture, economic opportunities, and corn prices, I'm not going to take that as a criticism. I'm going to take that as a compliment. I think that's one reason we're here, and we're thankful that we're helping farmers out. So
you can't grow sugar cane or anything in the South?
There is some sugar that can be grown in the United States, certainly some in the South, perhaps Louisiana. And then there's some sugar beets that, of course, are grown in the Red River Valley region of North Dakota and Minnesota. But we cannot grow the sugar that they do in Brazil, no. And, yes, it is very cheap to make ethanol from sugar in Brazil.
All right. I wanted to thank the caller and go on to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Getting back to an earlier question, the input-output BTU balance, does your 70% figure include the cost of growing the corn? Remember, you're using natural gas for the nitrogen input, and, of course, the farmer is using fuel of some sort. 70% sounds like there's room to maintain a positive balance, but how much does it diminish it, or don't you know?
Sure. That number, I believe, does include what it costs to grow the corn, what it costs to transport the corn from the farm to the ethanol facility, what it costs to process the corn into ethanol at the ethanol facility, and then finally the cost of shipping that product to the end user where it's blended with gasoline and then made available to consumers. And so it does include those things. Now, it doesn't include things like the cost of the steel that's made to make the manufacture of the farm equipment. And that's what some people do when they calculate the energy balance. And that's where you may have heard, well, ethanol has a negative energy balance. It's when they really go beyond the lines of what would be fair in calculating the costs that go into making ethanol.
Well, thank you. I do have one other question. With corn-based ethanol, the disposal of the refuse isn't a great problem because you can feed it. But with miscanthus and switchgrass, what are we going to do with this huge volume of residue?
That's a really good question, and I'm not an expert in that area, but the members of my organization that are working on this that we've talked to indicate there could be a wide variety of uses for the co-product, from using biomass to make ethanol. It could be that some of that is in the form of some sort of fertilizer base that can be then reapplied to agricultural lands or mixed with something else to be used as fertilizer. Some have made the argument that they think that product is still going to be somewhat valuable in terms of a livestock type of feed. And still others are looking at whatever remaining products there could be left from that, and then using that as something that's used with other materials to help co-fire or generate power for the ethanol plant. And so, again, that's a great question, and I'm not a technical expert on that, but I know that they're looking at making sure there are valuable uses for that product, which is something important for us to do throughout the entire ethanol production process, is find value from the products that are made.
Something I want to make sure that I ask, because it's come up a number of times here on this program as we've touched on this issue, and that has to do with water. Here, for example, in our area, some people have been talking about the possibility of building an ethanol plant, and that was one of the questions that seemed to concern people, that is, the amount of water that these plants take to make ethanol. How can you give me a number? How many gallons of water does it take to produce a gallon of ethanol?
Sure. I'll give you a basic rule of thumb, because I want to make it very clear that no two ethanol plants will be identical. One might be much more efficient than the other. But a good rule of thumb in the industry today is that it takes between 2.5 and 3 gallons of water to make a gallon of ethanol. And that's dramatically better than what it was just 5 or 10 years ago, where it took more water than that to make a gallon of ethanol. And the real exciting thing that is taking place is that ethanol producers know they need to be more efficient, and we're very well aware of some of the concerns about water availability and use when it comes to siting and building ethanol plants. And so technology developments are taking place to help squeeze down or reduce the amount of water that's used. And I'm confident we're going to get to a point in the future where most, if not all, of the water that's used in an ethanol plant is indeed recycled back through the process. Significant amounts of water are being recycled through ethanol plants today. But there's still work taking place to make sure that we can reuse more of that water. Because, again, we want to do this in a sustainable way. We want to be good neighbors. We want to do the right thing. And so a lot of work is taking place in that area.
I want to try to get at least one more caller, somebody who's on a cell phone in Columbus, Ohio. So we'll go there, line two. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple comments for you. I'd like for you to comment on, I guess, the response to one of your comments earlier. You had stated that there was little effect on the actual food supply. And I am a supplier of equipment and to meat processing facilities, and I can tell you that the cost of the grain is a major factor in a lot of their decisions coming up in the next couple of years. They're very frightened about how much corn is going to rise in price and the effect that's going to have on their profitability and the price of meat supplies in the future to the general public. And I'd also like to throw out a comment regarding other ancillary industries. You mentioned stainless steel. Stainless steel is on the rise. Prices are on the rise rapidly here, and we are understanding that a lot of that has to do with the amount of stainless steel that is required to construct these ethanol plants. And my last comment, please, is you had mentioned there's no silver bullet, and one thing I've always wondered is why the federal government, why the president doesn't ask the United States to start conserving.
Yeah.
We do not hear a general plan or a general idea from the federal government asking the United States, the people of the United States, to conserve, to do things, as many things as they can.
And I just got to, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm really sorry to cut in on you, because I'm almost out of time here. Mr. Jennings, I can give you about 30 seconds to a minute to respond to some of that, if you can.
I will try. I guess in reverse order, I've tried to make it clear here on the call that we, too, support conservation. Contact your members of Congress and the president to make that a bigger priority, a more important priority. Stainless steel demand, yes, that is up in part because we're building more and more ethanol plants, and so that's actually created more cost for building these plants, and it might slow the growth of building some of these plants in the future because stainless steel prices have gone up. And then the consumer price issue, I guess what I was trying to say is I don't think ethanol is causing food prices to go up. I do recognize, however, that prices are going up for the livestock sector and then meat processors and others that are affected by them, but I'm confident, again, corn supplies will increase in the future, and these prices will be cyclical like they have been historically.
We must stop there, but I promise people who are listening this will not be the last show we'll do on this subject. We'll continue to try to talk about it, but for the moment, we got to stop. Our guest is Brian Jennings. He's Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. If you're interested about the organization, learning about the organization, their website is www.ethanol.org, so you can go right there. And Mr. Jennings, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.